Okay, folks, we are at 7:30, so we'll go ahead and get started. So first thing I'll do, as per usual, I will mute all. You do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Or you can use chat. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to minimum. If I happen to see somebody unmuted and causing a lot of background noise, I will unceremoniously mute you. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck in a PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will get posted onto our website. Thanks to the hard work of Alan and a lot of his scripting work that he's been doing over the years, that he introduced us to some of it. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Thank you, Chris. And tonight we're going to start off with a couple of questions that came into suggestion box. So the first one is to do with a fairly new laptop that's running Windows 10, has support for Windows 11. The individual says that Norton was installed in December 22, but doesn't say whether that was the suite or just the antivirus product. I imagine it was a suite. But since January, she's been experiencing problems with boot time. It takes a long time for Windows to open, and accessing YouTube is also really slow. One of the things she's concerned about is that she uses this laptop for online banking, and she wonders if there's any issues with the time things are taking and whether or not the computer is actually secure. In terms of security, my guess is that if you have an antivirus program active, which Norton must be, and a firewall, so you've either got the suite running, in which case you'll have AV and the firewall, which is probably in the Norton security suite. And if it's only an AV package, then Windows itself should have an active firewall. So with both of those things activated, it should be that there's no security issue on the machine. So the real question is, why does it take so long for things to work? And to some extent, I guess this could be just general slowdown and things sludge created by Windows itself. And you probably remember a while ago we had a series of tech talks, and one of those was a series of tips on how to basically improve your computer's performance. So there's a whole raft of different things that we discuss and which you can do to try and speed things up. And just recently, Chris has produced an article in the March newsletter, which basically revisited all those types of items. So there's a lot of information here in the text, but there's also a whole raft of links to articles which are being provided in the newsletter over a number of years, covering a variety of useful topics. So if you have issues with slow boot times, then this is certainly an option to try some of these things and see if you can't actually speed things up. However, one of the things I've always wondered about how long it takes Windows to boot, because you can use a stopwatch and you know when the desktop actually loads for the first time, you get the pretty picture. But something's going on because things don't work real quick even when you've got the desktop running. So there's still things going on in the background. But I found this utility program, which I thought might be useful. It's called the Startup Timer. It's a freeware app. And in theory, it measures how long it takes for Windows to fully boot, which is, I guess, what you'd really like to know. And in theory, it says that it identifies the system processes, i.e. applications running through Windows itself, and also installed apps, so third-party programs which you have installed on your computer. And it tries to identify these apps that are making the startup process too slow. And there are both desktop or installable and portable versions of this product. And the developer says it's lightweight, there are no bells and whistles, and there's no nonsense. So if you want to try that, there's the URL. And when you go to that URL, you'll find it's a pretty lean and mean website. Just gives you some information about what Startup Timer does. And then as you scroll down the page, you'll get to the download section, where sure enough, there are links for a portable version. I decided to download what they call the setup version, which is the installable EXE program. So I downloaded this file. And since I don't know this company, and I'd never really heard about Startup Timer previously, there's not that many reviews out there on the web about it. So I decided I would be safe rather than sorry, and I ran it through VirusTotal. And interestingly enough, it shows up with two security issues, or two security systems are flagging this as potentially malicious. And so if you dive down into that a little bit more, you'll find that the ones that found it were something called CrowdStrike Falcon and another one called Secure Age. And they just say that, this one says it's malicious and this one says it's not sure about it or something. And I've never heard of these two things, but I've heard of a bunch of other things. So if you look down the list here, you'll find that Avast and AVG and Avira and Bitdefender and ClanAV have all decided that this executable program has no security threats in it. And if you scroll even further down the list, you'll find that ESET, Malwarebytes, and Microsoft, Norton, Symantec, all the Sophos, all the kind of big players in the game haven't found anything bad. Anyway, I double checked and I went onto the user forum for this company. And sure enough, there have been issues like this in the past, and the developer had flagged it as false positives. But I sent him a note anyway. I said, this is the latest version. I downloaded it in mid-May. And I pointed out that there were two people flagged it. And I said, I see that other products have been tagged like this in the past. Is this also a false positive? And a few days later, I get this. Yes, it is a false positive. And interestingly, he says, unfortunately, VirusTotal includes some antivirus products which rarely get updated. So false positives take a long time to essentially get out of that system. So that may or may not be the case. So you have to decide now. Two out of however many it was flagging this as potentially malicious a problem, or do we go with all the other ones that we know and love that say there's no problem? Or alternatively, you can hedge. So I like to hedge. So my strategy is A, to immediately create a full hard drive image, which I can then restore to exactly that point in time if things go south. Once I have my disk image tucked away, I can install the program and I can run it. And when you run it, you get this screen here and you basically have a box, a control button, if you like, to restart the computer. So you click on this to restart the computer and the machine reboots. And eventually you get this screen here, which says Startup Timer is waiting for the system to fully start. Don't do anything. Don't even move the mouse. So basically, you just let it run, and then it will then revert to screen like this, which says that Windows started in 56 seconds, the desktop was loaded in 50 seconds, and then it gives some information about the system it's running on. It's running on Windows 10 Home, it's a Core i7, running at 2 gig, and the 16 gig of memory. Interesting enough, when they say fully started, what they say is Windows has started and they're monitoring the CPU usage, and that has dropped to less than 5%. So again, still things could be happening, but you're at least 95% of the way there. So that's pretty good. So my machine booted in 56 seconds. And then if I, as part of that message, lower down in the message description, it tells me what it thinks is wrong. And it says these apps, these processes are slowing down the system startup. And Glasswire is basically accounting for 77% of the issue. Interestingly, Explorer, Windows Explorer, or File Explorer, I guess, one of the two, that's a Microsoft system utility, is responsible for 17% of the slowdown. And I've also got a third-party app called Stickies, which is good for 1.6%. So if you discount the Microsoft products, the things that are causing the problems, if it goes back a slide, are Glasswire, which is my third-party firewall, and Stickies, which is a sticky note on the desktop type application. So when my machine boots, it loads this little yellow note on the desktop and reminds me that I'm running on a metered connection, so Windows can't necessarily update itself unless I allow it to. So I thought, well, basically I'll just disable these two things and rerun startup timer and see what happens. So I go into the apps and I find Glasswire and I disable it. However, there's no listing for Stickies. And if I went into control panel, there's the only thing I can do is basically uninstall the app. I can't find anywhere where I can disable Stickies and then re-enable it later on. But you remember I had this backup image and I'm a little bit dubious about this potential malware in this product. So my plan was always to restore Windows anyway. So I'm basically quite happy to uninstall Stickies and see what happens, because it will come back again when I do my restore. So sure enough, I run the startup timer again, and now it boots in 49 seconds. My desktop comes up in 44. And now the things that are causing the main problems are all Windows system stuff, which I'm not going to touch with a barge pole. So if you look at the differences, originally my machine fully booted according to this timer program in 56 seconds. I uninstalled Glasswire basically. It now boots in 59 seconds. I saved the whole 7 seconds. But now my firewall isn't running anymore. So I'm pretty happy to stick with 56 seconds and not worry about the extra 7 seconds I could have saved on the boot time. So it's going to be interesting, but it's not, for me, that's not a compelling app. So I'm pretty happy just to restore my machine back to the original and ignore startup timer. But if you want to know how long it takes your system to boot, then there's an app that you can try.
You never tried it? You never tried it with the second boot? How long it would take? What's delaying that?
Right there, 49 seconds.
But
the second one?
Is the percentage?
All these things right here. Now it's this system app, which is 60%. Explorer is still about 14%. And SVC host 7%. So that's good for what, 60, 70, 80% right there.
Well, what's that EED underscore SL?
I don't know. It's a system app. It's a Windows program. I don't know what it is, and I'm not prepared to find out. So there we go. All right. Anything else in there, Chris?
Just Tom pointed out that you could use auto runs from Mark Rusinovich of Microsoft fame to find out where things are auto starting from. It's more comprehensive certainly than using Task Manager, but it's a whole lot more complex as well. I think most people, Task Manager gives you probably the level of information on startup apps that you probably can deal with very easily.
Yeah, except again, I think that one had Stickies was hidden there. It didn't show up. So maybe I should use auto runs. Anyway, there we go. All right, so the next item is a question that came in about a printer, which Chris is going to chat about.
Yeah, so Martin Rice sent this in, and he was helping somebody organize for a move, I believe it was, and they discovered an HP printer, several years old. I don't have the model number or anything like that. It was never opened, and he said that in his research, he found that it was actually compatible with Windows 11. And he was wondering if anybody here has suggestions for some agency or charity that would accept it as a donation and it would go to a good cause. So next. So Alan and I, our first talk was actually Alan thought of this, CompuCore. They gave a presentation going back January 2019 to the OPC UG. And this is straight off their website, so quoting exactly, the aim of this is to donate to our tech youth, tech monitor, and in this case, tech reuse programs, make a real difference in the lives of those at risk and most in need in across Canada. So it is a charity, and it will go to a good cause for sure. And they have a hardware button you can click on to donate hardware, or you can make cash donations. And the URL is there, and it's pasted into the chat as well. Next. A couple of other thoughts that I had. I forget who it is. Somebody has given talks on Trash Nothing, a site here in Ottawa. They actually have sites around the world, but there is one centered on Ottawa, and it's where you can go to if you've got stuff to give away or you want free stuff that other people are giving away. And so the one thing about this is it's not a charity, so it will be going, you know, you'd be offering it up to anybody who decides, hey, yeah, I'd like a free printer. So if you're really looking for it to going to a charity or something like that, that wouldn't be an option. To me, the sort of last option would be e-waste. So the URL is there, and there are drop-offs at Best Buy and Staples all around town, usually just inside the front door, and they'll have a big bin, and you can just drop it off there. And I say it's a last resort because it will be scrapped as opposed to reused, but it will be done in an environmentally friendly way. So it has that sort of benefit. So I'm throwing out here the idea that if anybody else has any other ideas, we'll revisit this topic towards the end of the meeting, or you can throw it in the chat if you have any other ideas for where people could go to donate something, where it'll go get reused in a charity or something like that. By all means, throw it into the chat, and we'll revisit that later on.
Yeah, Tom mentioned recycle.org, which I'm not sure if that's part of that Trash Nothing thing, or it's very similar anyway. Kijiji has a giveaway option.
Okay.
And Craigslist, he says.
Yeah.
So those are all the same kind of deal where it's something that you don't want anymore and you think somebody else might be able to reuse it. It's kind of a shame for a brand new high-priced laser printer. I'm sure somebody can make really good, better use of it than that.
I would think so, yeah.
Okay, moving along, we've got an item here from Bob Harris. Bob, are you going to talk to this?
I could try and say a bit, I guess.
Go for it.
Well, this is back to Chat GPT. I like to read news, and this feature is very handy for that. I tend to keep a window open now for chat on my computer. I usually have many windows open. So if you would like to read a large amount of text, you don't need to use capital letters, but in Chat GPT, just type in TL semicolon DR, and that means too long, didn't read. And you can go to a large website. Like for mine, it's usually news. And just highlight the first few words with your mouse and essentially use your mouse to highlight all the text you want to read, and it'll summarize it for you and condense it, make it much more readable in literally 1 second, and it works very well. It's free. Use it as often as you want. And this is the one that I sent to Alan, and it wasn't a any given website, you highlight, you find all this text here. The website, it's a fairly long story to read. If you're reading news in the morning, I bookmark, well, I have like 20 plus websites I open in the morning, and I just sort of skim through them and read what I wanted to read in that given day. And there's a text. I think Alan did a great job counting the words here. It knocked it all down. We threw in two pages of text, threw in a few pictures, but didn't count those. But 975 words of text. And it boiled that down like maple syrup into 275 words. So it's about around a quarter of the original text. And the shift key is very handy for this. I don't know if other folks can elaborate on that, but when you paste your stuff in, I often use the shift key to, I don't think it matters with chat, to paste it with no attributes, but it's very handy.
So B says it's amazing, but did you check for accuracy?
I read a few of the articles in full, and I'm very content. It captures the spirit of the article.
Does it rephrase stuff, or is it just throwing sentences away?
I can't say I got involved in that much of a scrutiny. For my purposes, I'm content that it works well for me, and so I haven't gone that far, really. But I like it. I use it almost every day.
Elizabeth says she might see how well it summarizes the auto insurance document.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. Moving on, we've got the Loony Bits item from Stuart. So, Stuart, if you want to unmute your microphone, and we'll move to the first of your items.
Unmuted and ready to babble. Everything tick-related. Oh, we've all heard of ticks, eh? Well, every spring there seems to be a little or a resurgence of interest in the species of insect known as ticks. And this spring is no exception. There is a website that is Canadian, and it's for tracking ticks and taking pictures of them. It's kind of like a paparazzi for ticks, I guess you could describe it as. Ticks by the poolside, ticks, driving their luxury cars. I'll try to focus here. Ticks, in general, tracking them, identifying them, and helpful advice on how to get rid of them if they happen to be sucking your blood in particular. It's pretty straightforward. I can't say anything more about it. If you want to contribute to the website and increase the database on where people are spotting ticks because you've encountered them, I'd say go and share your knowledge. Or if you're looking for knowledge about ticks, here's a place to go that's talking about ticks in Canada by the poolside. How about the next one? Okay, hot off the wire. Everybody's heard that phrase, eh? It's hot off the wire. When you're talking to reporters and news information and all this stuff. Well, some time ago, following attributions in various news articles, I wound up on the website newswire.ca. And this seems to be where reporters get and give all their information about what's going on. I don't have an account, so I can't log in and see what is going on behind the scenes. But if you just go down to where it says browse all news stories, you will get a constantly updated list of what's going on today. And there's, like, Bob will love this. It's just random news about anything and everything going on across the country. There are even occasionally stories where there'll be a, a note saying not for redistribution in the United States or something like this. And it's usually something about stocks or, you know, money of some sort. It's a lot of obscure stuff and a lot of stuff that may be relevant to your daily life. Check it out. Bomb. I don't have much more to say about it. It's just news, news, news. So what's the last one we've got? I got to try and stretch this out because I'm going too fast. Chris pronounced this really well earlier, and I'm not going to try and replicate his enunciation of the, the title for this website. But if you want to complain about your television or telecommunication services, this is the place to go. www.ccts-cprst.ca. That was easier to say than the actual name of the place. But this is basically for and only for complaints and issues to do with television, telecommunications, and sharing that information, not just with the public in general, but the industry as a whole, so they can tune up their act. Did you know that every service provider for telecommunications is supposed to tell you about this website, where you can make a complaint about them if you need to? And did you know that this information is supposed to be on its own web page or own page on each provider's site, not more than two clicks away from the home page? I'd like to experiment with that myself if I find some time, but
Carol, I'm sure we all vaguely...
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I'm sure we all vaguely remember seeing some boilerplate about if there's any issues, you can go to this website and you have to take out a magnifying glass to read the fine print about where it is and who it is and how to do it. Well, this is the website, and you can just bookmark this. And if you want to beef about something that you just remembered, you can do it anytime without going to your provider's website and trusting them to pass on the news. I got to say, you know, I don't have a lot of complaints lately. In my personal instance, the telecom services for me have been darn good. So having said that, it's probably all going to go straight to hell in a handbasket. But I know in the past I've had problems and others have problems, and you only hear about the problems in the news. So if you're having problems, I really recommend you use this website and air them in the right room. Not just shouting out the window, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, because that's been done and it didn't do any good. So that's all I've got this week, folks.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Stuart. And Stuart's always asking if anybody else has Canadian websites that might be of interest to us. And I've been looking at Raspberry Pis lately, and Bea's going to be really upset because they're not crusty things with red filling. My Raspberry Pi of interest is a single board computer. And it turns out there are two I found, Canadian websites that sell Raspberry Pis. First one is called Canakit, which is based in North Vancouver. So if you buy from them, you unless you're ready for a long drive, then you probably have to pay shipping. But the other company that does more or less the same stuff is PiShop. It used to be called buyapi.ca, and recently they've changed their name to PiShop.ca. And the neat thing about this is that they're based right in Ottawa. They're on Colonnade Road. So I believe you can go and knock on the door or ring the bell and actually buy direct from the store. So anything Raspberry Pi and a whole rack of other kind of single board computers are available, or at least the details are on that website. Some of these single board things are in pretty short supply right now. But it seems as though some things, notably the 4 gigabyte Raspberry Pi 3B kit, seems to be in stock. Whereas some of the other things are still waiting on this part shortage and supply chain issues and so forth. So things won't actually materialize for maybe a few months yet. But some things are available, so if you're interested in Raspberry Pi or any single board computer, then check out pishop.ca. Okay, carrying on. Chris has got an update on his favorite power toys.
Yeah, everybody probably knows that I'm a big fan of the power toys. It's a free set of utilities that run on Windows 10 or 11. And they come out of, they started with Microsoft employees actually doing these, and then other people got involved in the project. It's now hosted on GitHub, and any programmer can actually take part in the development of these tools. You can see from the URLs there that I've covered this quite frequently. And before I forget, let me just paste all of these links in. And done. Now they just released this week version 0.70.0. And you notice the leading zero means that they have not actually released an official release of this yet. They used to actually call them pre-release. Now they don't even call them that. They don't call it a beta. It's not really beta software. It's fully fledged software, but they just call it 0.70.0. I don't know if they will ever get to a 1.0 release. This week they included in the 0.70 are two new power toys, Mouse Without Borders and Peak, and we'll take a look at these next. So Mouse Without Borders is really cool. It's really only useful for people who use two or more computers, and generally as a side-by-side. So you're working on one computer, you've got another computer that is beside you that you have to periodically interact with in some form or fashion, and it allows you to use one keyboard and mouse to interact with both or more computers. You can do up to four. You can also share clipboard contents between the two machines, so you can cut or copy on one computer and then paste on the other. And you can also copy files between the two machines. Next. So the way it works here is that on your main computer, you'll be using the mouse and keyboard to control both of the computers. Next. The second computer, or third and fourth computer, they can have a mouse and keyboard, but they don't have to have a mouse and keyboard. If they do have a mouse and keyboard, there's nothing to prevent you from just going over to that computer and actually using it the way you would have before Mouse Without Borders. So you can actually continue to use them in their normal fashion. Next. So as you move the mouse, and as soon as it hits the edge of the screen, next, the mouse will actually jump over to the screen on the other computer. And then whatever computer screen the mouse cursor appears on, any mouse actions or keystrokes will take effect on that particular computer. Next. So just as an example of what you can do with it, copying a clipboard. So on the main computer, you could go into any program, your editor or web browser or whatever, copy content to the clipboard, just control C or right click and choose copy, or use a menu option. However you normally do copy operations, you just do that normal operation. Next. And then you move the mouse to the second computer, and then all of a sudden, any actions you take will be taking place on that particular computer. So if you're, saying, pasting content into a document, so you'd open up the document, put the cursor where you want in that document, where you want that content, and then you just paste the clipboard. And the content will be the content that you actually copied to the clipboard on the other computer. And again, you just do your normal operations for pasting. Control V, right-click to paste, or a menu option, or a toolbar, or something like that to paste the content in. Next. And then the clipboard contents will be pasted into the document as if it actually just came from wherever you're on that particular computer. Next. The other thing you can do is copying files. So on the main computer, what you can do is go into File Explorer, and I don't think that this works actually with other file managers, but if you go into File Explorer, you can select one or more files and then copy them. And again, normal operation on however you do your copies. Control C, right click, choose copy, or use toolbar option in File Explorer to do a copy. Next. Then you move the mouse to the secondary computer. And again, as soon as the mouse is over there, any operations are going to take place on that computer. So you can go into File Explorer and then paste. Either Control V, right click, choose paste, or choose toolbar option for paste. And next. Here the file will be copied from the main computer to the secondary computer. Or you can do the reverse as well. There are an awful lot of options available within it. The configuration screen is quite long. You can actually control up to four computers, so your main computer and up to three secondary computers, and you can actually arrange them in whatever order you want, so one to the left, one to the right, or however you want to arrange them. You can make it, if you don't like that idea of as soon as your mouse cursor hits the edge of the screen, it jumps to the other one. You can actually turn it on so that you have to hold down either the shift key or optionally the alt or the control key. And then when you move the mouse to the edge of the screen, it'll then jump to the other screen. But without the shift and control, the mouse will be trapped on the one computer it is on at that particular point in time. You can have a hotkey that it'll lock your secondary screen or all screens at once. You can set up a hotkey to switch between the computers. If you don't want to use that idea of moving the mouse manually, you can actually do it as like Alt-F1 or something like that, Alt-F2 for the second computer, Alt-F3 for the third computer, that sort of thing, to have the mouse cursor jump to the other computer. And there are some additional options in there. If you do want to do this, the tutorial is really, really worth reading. I found it a little bit confusing when I was installing it the first time, and I wasn't getting it working properly. And when I saw the tutorial, I saw what it was that I was doing wrong. So if you want it, it's great. Check out the tutorial, and that'll get you hitting the ground running. Next. The other option is Peek. And it allows you to preview the contents of files. This is a quote off of Microsoft that it supports various file types, including images, web pages, markdown files, text files, and developer files. Whenever anybody says including, it makes me wonder, well, what else is there? I found out it actually works with PDF files as well. So if you peek on a PDF file, it'll come up in a window and show you the contents of that. Interestingly, it doesn't work with Microsoft Office file types, which I would have thought would be a real natural for them to build in that capability. Maybe it'll be expanded to that in the future. I'm not sure I really see the point of this particular power toy. I just open it up in the native app. If your default program takes a long time to open, this might be faster. And one of the nice things about it is once it's in that preview, there is a button where you can say, okay, I want to open this in the native app now if I want to edit the file or whatever. Again, there's a tutorial, but it's a real short tutorial. I doubt anybody would really have a problem getting Peek to work properly. Next. So the way that this works is I've selected two files, and then I press the hotkey, which is the default of control space, but you can convert that to something else if you wanted a different hotkey. Next. And then you end up with the preview window opening as you see there. So this is a JPEG file, so it's just a graphic, and it just opens up in a preview window like that. So it is fast, but for me, I use UrbanView, and it opens just as fast in UrbanView, so I don't see the point really of this. Next. If you happen to have more than one file selected, you do have one of two, one of three, or five of 10, or whatever you've got open, where you can use the left and right arrow keys to scroll backwards and forwards through the files that you've selected. Next. And then you also have a button there always to click to open it in the default app for that particular program on your computer. And that's it. So getting the power toys, it is one monolithic installation. You don't get just, you know, don't install them individually or anything like that. There are 21 power toys right now. If you don't want any of them, you can disable any of the ones you don't want to use. They're all highly configurable, and the URL is there on the screen, and it's in the chat, and on how to get it. So I highly recommend that people check out Power Toys. Really nice set of apps. This particular Reese had one oddity I found, was that with Mouse Without Borders, it prevented on my main computer from the monitor to go to sleep. If it goes to sleep within a few seconds, it comes alive again. I bugged it at the GitHub repository, and they confirmed the bug, and it is due for release at some future point. And that's all I have on the power toys.
So is there a trick in the download? Chris, you've got another build here.
Yeah. Go ahead to the next slide. Yeah. So if you go to that page, the releases page, near the top will be the most recent, and then you scroll down to where it says assets and next. The file that you're actually looking for is called Power Toys Setup - and then the version number, whatever it happens to be. Right now it's 0.70.0-x86.exe. You can ignore all the other ones that are listed there. They're for specialized purposes and things like that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Tom has a note that the program Everything also has a peak in its app these days. Everything is a third-party search engine. And Stuart's asking about the mouse power toy, and do all the computers have to be Windows based? He assumes they do.
Yes, they do all have to be Windows based. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So going back to Stuart's hot off the wire, here's a hot off the wire question, since it came in this evening, and I think it's Glenn is asking, he's thinking of using the Backer Upper program, which Chris reviewed in February 2016, and he's asking about the current version. So do you have any insight into those things, Chris?
No, not really. I mean, I looked at the AOME site tonight, and it seems to be very similar to what was listed before. I don't imagine that it has deteriorated as a program. So I think it probably still is a very good image backup program. I guess one of the things was, you know, do you get much performance increase in the paid version? I really don't know performance differences. They do say that the paid version is faster, but they don't give any details on that. There is a feature comparison, and I'll paste that into the page to it, into there. And I would encourage anybody to, first off, try out AOME Backupper. If you're interested in it at all, try out the free version. It may be all you need. But then look at the feature page and see if there are additional features that are available in the paid version that you'd be really interested in. Unfortunately, one of the things with AMA Backupper, when I did the initial review, they had a steal of a deal where for the paid version, you could get a lifetime subscription to it for, I think, double the price of a one-year subscription to the program or the next release or something like that. So you could get all future releases for just doubling the price of the normal. That seems to be gone. So you're really into, you're just buying, you know, that version, and I guess any bug fixes that come out, when a new version comes out, presumably you'd have to buy it again or pay an upgrade fee or something like that. So they took away one of the more attractive features of it, but as a whole, I found AMA Backupper to be quite a good program, and it actually did pretty much everything that I was looking for in a backup program. So if anybody else is using the program, please chime in on what you think of it.
It's interesting that they say that the paid version is faster. I don't think I've ever heard that before. It's usually the paid version gives you more features, or the free version has those other features disabled.
Yeah, in actual fact, I've seen that before, and Ease Us to Do Backup does that as well. The free version, they say that the paid versions, they say, run faster. But I never did a comparison on it. Quite frankly, when I'm doing my backups, it's in the middle of the night. I don't really care how long it takes. And so I just let it run. On my laptop computers that I just do about once a month because they have nothing terribly important on them, I just plug in the backup drive, let it run, and when it's done, it's done. I don't care if it takes half an hour or 2 hours.
It says the free version takes copy break.
Could well be.
Okay. Well, we're at that time. The last 10 minutes, that is about the last 14 minutes. I did see there's a whole raft of stuff about free giveaways early on, so we'll go back and see what we can find there. But in the meantime, if anybody has any additional questions or things that they'd like to share with the group right now, feel free to chime in.
If I have a problem when I go out of the Zoom meeting to make a note on Windows document or something, and
okay.
I can't go back into Zoom meeting. Can you tell me how I do that?
So this is Notepad we're talking about?
No. LibreOffice Writer. If I go from watching the Zoom meeting and I want to copy something into LibreOffice Writer, I can't get back into Zoom meeting. What am I doing wrong?
I don't know, because I
have to reboot into Zoom.
If you just go to the Notepad, you should be able to get back to any other running program like Zoom with Alt-Tab.
What are you talking about?
Well, I'm in Zoom right now, and I'm running LibreOffice.
Have you tried Alt-Tab?
No, but I might lose this conversation if I try it.
You won't. It'll just switch between what you can see.
Oh, okay. I'll try it.
Do you exit full screen? So you're running Zoom in a window.
I'm running with the chat on the right hand side and side by side speaker.
Yeah, but is Zoom running full screen? Like, can you see any of your desktop? See, I'm running Zoom here. I've got Zoom running. I've got my screen share. I've got the meeting chat over here. I had there's LibreOffice, and they're all running in Windows.
Yes, but how do you view these without able to go back to Zoom?
Just close them.
I said I'd do Alt-Tab. I'll try that and see what happens.
Yes, there's two ways to move between running programs. One is Alt-Tab, and it gives you a kind of a preview of the window, and then you keep on Alt-Tabbing until you reach the preview of the window that you want. Windows Tab does the same sort of thing, except I think that it puts... If you're using multiple monitors, then it puts the previews in each of the monitors according to where they will show up when you maximize them or when you switch to them.
Okay, so going back to that giveaway stuff, Allison says that on her local Buy Nothing group, there's somebody who takes computers, cleans them up, and gives them to people in need. So there's an option. Carol,
it works. Thank you.
Carol Pearson notes HFW Ottawa, which I think is help with furniture or something like that, where they collect furniture and give it away to people like refugees, new immigrants. And Jeff Dubois says Catholic Center for New Immigrants might be giving computers to newcomers in need, might be able to find a home for a printer there. I think that might be, I don't see anything else in terms of giveaways and so forth. Okay, so does anybody have any other questions?
Just going back to Hiomi Backupper, that we had a piece in there for Serge Eric saying that there was a Hiomi Backupper Professional 1-year giveaway. So if you want the program, if you can still get it, that's great. It'll actually give you a 1-year subscription to it, I guess. Just looking down the feature comparison, some of the things you don't get if you're in the free version, a little bit slower if you're with the free version, but some of the other feature-wise, backup scheme, which allows you to have the program automatically delete older backups to make room for new. That's kind of nice. Differential backup doesn't come with the free, but incremental does. I don't think most people care about differential backup. That gives you your main backup and then all of the changes since the main backup. And then if you run it again the next day, you only end up with 2 files that way. But you can only go back to, you know, your, when you ran the full backup and then your latest differential, you lose all of those in between days, to be able to do recovery. The ability to, select some files you don't want backed up. That is not in the free version. I think most people, that probably isn't a really big deal. You get real-time syncing capabilities in the paid version as well. So I use file history from Microsoft Windows to do real-time backup, but this would give you that real-time syncing of files built into the paid version of Backupper. Cloning, there's some limitations to the ability to clone. You can only do disk partitions for cloning, not the system partition, if that makes a difference. That's a paid version. Most of the other things probably are not of great concern to most people. So those are sort of the highlights of the things that you get in the paid version, which appears to be $39.95, and I'm presuming that's U.S.
Okay, Tom had looked up that EEDSL.exe, the program that was taking all the time on my second startup timer exercise. Turns out it's the eco driver for my Samsung printer. Well, since I actually like using the eco driver, so I'm not going to disable that either.
Yeah, that's the thing with an awful lot of things that are taking startup time. Well, if it's a program that you want, then okay, you have to live with it. You know, you were talking about explorer.exe. Well, besides being File Explorer, it is also the Windows shell. So the desktop is actually run by explorer.exe. You can't run without it. And so, and you know, you talked about the Glasswire. Well, Glasswire provides a good deal of security. So, you know, do you want to give it up for shave a few seconds off of your boot time? I think I'd rather have the protection afforded by that particular program. But if you do see programs that are taking up a lot of time and you don't actually use those programs, then those are great candidates for being either disable the startup and only run them when you want them, or get rid of them entirely and then you don't have issues around potential bugs in it that are going to be security issues in the future and things like that. So just uninstall those programs. You'll gain the disk space and you'll gain the memory and CPU processing time that those programs are taking away from you if you have no need for them.
I think I read somewhere, though, Chris, that Explorer.exe actually has a built-in delay. And I think that's maybe the thing that you could eliminate. But, you know, my machine boots in less than a minute, so do I really care?
There's also another thing you can do if you want to speed things up, but it may take a little research. If you go into your services, you'll notice that you have a choice between, auto start manual, off or auto start delayed, and if you know which services you can delay, you can switch those from auto start to auto start delay. But if you don't know what a service does, don't try to delay it. Although Windows will probably prevent you from doing bad things, I wouldn't guarantee it. But some services like the print spooler or other things that you may not need in the first minute or two. Then you may want to put them on auto start delay. There's probably also a whole bunch of web pages about how to speed up stuff. I'm presuming we're all using SSDs, so it doesn't actually help. But you can, if you're using a hard disk to boot from, there are ways that Windows can speed that up by using prefetch. And apparently, I think that's set by default, so you shouldn't have a problem with it. And one of the programs I mentioned way a long time ago called MyDefrag allows you to actually move the things that are in prefetch right to the edge of the hard disk so that they load faster, and it puts them all together so they load in like sequential format. It sets them. That's one of the options in MyDefrag.
Yeah, a couple of things in the chat which people might be interested in, not necessarily computer related. Doors Open Ottawa is on June the 3rd and 4th, and if you haven't tried that, look at the listing, which is also in the chat, and see what various agencies are throwing their doors of their agencies open. Some quite interesting tours that you can take basically for free. And then somewhere I saw Tom had posted Ontario craft breweries which deliver and have deals. There you go. Now you're talking my language, Tom.
Oh, that open house, if you decide to go on it, you have to make sure some of them, if I remember correctly, you had to register before it, and some didn't. They were controlled amount of people that went into those places, and some didn't have a control limit.
Yeah, like the American Embassy, you can never get in because you have to register 3 months ahead, I think.
Yeah, they have to check you out through 97 million databases. Also, regarding open house, it's not both days for all things. You should look at the open house website, and it'll tell you when things are. I also created a map for it in Google, and if you go there, you can see where everything is and what they are. And if you click on the hot air balloons, you can find out all the details as to what times they're open and whether there's a shuttle and other details that I took from the Open Data Ottawa website.
So there's an interesting note here from Elizabeth on her iPhone 11 using autofill. She says it disappointed me often, but yesterday it substituted, picked off the marigold heads for fine marigold heads. So now she wants to know she's going to investigate how to control autofill. I'm sure you can disable that somewhere. Okay, I don't see anything else that we've missed, so if there's anything else, we can revisit it next week. I'll just do the wrap-up while we're thinking about things. And I just remind Ottawa PCU group members, if you're intending to go to the pizza party at Britannia Park on June the 14th. That's now only 2 weeks away. Remember that this year you have to register. So we're trying to find out how many people are going to be so we don't end up with millions of too many slices of pizza. So please register if you want to go to the pizza party. And for those of you who know all about cookies, and these are the computer kind, one of our members wants to know about cookies. What cookies are being used by websites? What do they do? Which ones are required? Which ones can you refuse? And how can you refuse them? And the example he gave was CBC have a webpage where you can view the cookie types that they use. There are 73 different types of cookies that CBC.ca uses, which blows my mind. Anyway, if you know all about cookies and you can answer some of those questions, Chris and I, we know that they exist and we live with them. We don't really know very much about them. So we're looking for somebody who would like to try and answer these questions for our member.
In particular, overall, I just think of cookies as they are required for, at least some of them are required for proper functioning of websites. I don't want to fight with trying to figure out things, so I just let them go. In particular, I would really like to hear from anybody who has some arguments to be made for why cookies can be evil if there's something that you can actually do about it that is reasonable and is not going to take up a great deal of my time and effort. I'd be actually very interested in hearing about what am I doing wrong, what don't I get right about this. So if anybody has that insight, I would love to hear from them.
One of the things that you do need cookies for is banking applications.
Yeah.
I don't think you can hit a bank without them sending you cookies. They're a necessary evil in some respects.
Alan, you should never hit a bank. Really.
Okay, so before the pizza party, we still have one more Q&A session, which will be next week, June the 7th. So if you know the answer to the cookie problem or you have any other questions or topics that you'd like to share with the group, there's the address to send us the details, and we'll be happy to add you to next week's agenda. But as far as I can see, that's it for me. Tom has got his hand up. Go ahead.
Aside from eating and talking, is there anything special planned for this pizza party? Some computer game that we can play manually or anything special?
Nothing planned that I know of.
We'll be too busy eating to play games. And drinking your craft beer. Okay, we'll see you all next week. Bye.
Thanks, folks. Bye.